What can you tell me about that? There were no reactors in those days outside of what the government had, is that correct?
Well, all the reactors we had in those days were plutonium production reactors, or pilot plants to make them, provide the design confirmation for the other plants. And the first my memory's so poor. Let me try to get organized on this. Gosh, I can't remember when the Hanford. I must have something here. Association, let's tell her, see if I can find it.
What was the purpose of the Reactor Safeguard Committee?
Well, the first problem that the Reactor Safeguard Committee had to consider was the hazard that the plutonium production reactors at the Hanford site in central Washington might represent, whether in the operation of those reactors there was a possibility of the inadvertent accumulation of a critical mass of plutonium. And even though at that time I knew nothing about reactor design, as the chemical engineering member of what was then called the Reactor Safeguard Committee, they had physical chemists and chemical engineers and experimental physicists and theoretical physicists, and we had Abel Wolman, who was professor of I wish my memory was better. He was on the biological or medical side of these things. It was a very good committee. Groves assembled some of the best people in the country for it, and Edward Teller was our chairman. Teller had invited me to serve as a chemical engineering member because he had and I had worked together, sometimes at cross purposes, during the operation of the startup of the gaseous diffusion plant. And that was my first knowledge of or exposure to the more important side of the Manhattan Project, namely the plutonium project, because we had known that these sites existed in the West to do something, but because of the compartmentalization, we weren't even told what they were producing. We weren't even told that there was such an element as plutonium. So on my first trip out to Hanford to see the world's first transmutation factory, it was, well, I knew the world would never be the same again. Really an eye-opener. I must have gone out there and, when was it? I guess it was either just before or just after I reported to MIT 1950 or 51. I do have a, in fact, you do have a abbreviated biography here, don't you? That
tells us in the case.
This is the one I'm looking for. Prior association with Edward Teller during the Manhattan Project led to my appointment as the first chemical engineering member of the Reactor Safeguard Committee Teller formed for the Atomic Energy Commission in 1947.
Okay.
So our first problem was possible accumulation of a critical mass in the them being started up Hanford reactors, and I was sent out to Hanford to see them. And this is, makes a suitable point to digress. The Hanford reactors were located on the west bank of the Columbia River, about, I don't know exactly how many miles, say 50 or 60 miles north of Richland, Washington, on exactly the site where back in the summer of 1930, I had slept on a haystack and ran a sprayer and fruit picker in the orchards of a fruit farmer. And the contrast between the idyllic, remote, rural setting that I had in this beautiful site on the banks of the pristine Columbia River and the erection there of the world's first transmutation factory, with all the military implications and security safeguards and all the rest of it, was such a contrast that showed me how the world had changed irrevocably with the discovery of nuclear fission.
I may be a little ahead with this question, but let me ask it anyways. Given your 1930 experiences in Chicago and then your work on fission for the atomic bomb project and then moving into nuclear engineering, what was your attitude about the responsibility of a scientist, the social responsibility of a scientist?
Well, I've been ashamed. I think I've even said in my autobiography that I'm ashamed to confess now that I had really no concern or not much thought about the social responsibility or the use of this terribly violent new explosive that we were developing. During the war, it was simply a challenge to develop the material to bring the war to a brief and successful conclusion. And while I had colleagues who were much more concerned than I was about the future control of this new and violent aspect of society, it was something that I gave very little thought to. I was just concerned with helping end the war and develop this particular means for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ashamed to admit it now, but that was the fact at the time.
Well, no, because Hoyt Hoddle was head of fire warfare during World War II. And after the war, then set up the fire prevention group at NBS in response to his activities.
And I became a member of the first reactor safeguard committee.
How did you make the connection with MIT, to go back to MIT, within the chemical engineering department? There was no nuclear engineering.
No, I'll tell you exactly how it was. I may even have written it in one of these chapters. When I was working for the M.W. Kellogg Company in ...1943 or so, and had been assigned the process design responsibilities for the gaseous diffusion plant, Kellogg had Walter Whitman, who was then chairman of the chemical engineering department at MIT, as a consultant, to come down and review what we were doing. And I don't remember exactly what I did that so impressed Whitman, but I knew the process backwards and forwards, and I knew all its possible difficulties and how we were going to solve them, and I must have explained all this to Whitman in such clear and forceful terms that it made a lasting impression on him. And I don't know whether he was instrumental in getting me appointed to the Reactor Safeguard Committee. I think he may have been. But at any rate, when MIT was decided after the war that nuclear developments had to be treated somehow in their curriculum, and the subject was to be taught and research was to be done at MIT, the various department heads, physics and engineering school, were brought together and asked which of them might properly become headquarters for this new activity. And Whitman had served in Washington as chairman of some committee or other that had general oversight of some of these processes, and was a very aggressive administrator and a very progressive person, and recognized that there were many elements of chemical engineering in what later became known as nuclear engineering. So he strongly supported having this new activity put in his department, and won out over the physics department, which also wanted it, which might have been a more logical place for it because so much of the development was in physics. And Whitman had been a consultant to the M.W. Kellogg Company and came down there on a day when I was starting up a flow calorimeter to measure the heats of reaction in petroleum refining processes. I had never assembled the whole unit before. It consisted of a set of coils through which the reaction mixture was to be, or the compound, the hydrocarbon to be cracked or reformed, was to be circulated, surrounded by a series of insulating and thermocouple installed compartments, and the whole thing submerged in either an oil bath or a few salt bath, depending on the temperature at which we were to be working. I think when Whitman came down, it was an oil bath that was to be used around it. And we had never assembled the whole thing before. We had the calorimeter in one place and the oil bath beneath it mounted on a hydraulic lift. But we never assembled the unit before. But I was so certain that the assembly would proceed smoothly that we waited until Whitman came down so that he could see the calorimeter before it was lost to sight. And then while he was there, I instructed my assistant to throw the switch that would raise the hydraulic lift and bring the oil bath up around the calorimeter. The two fitted together perfectly. Whitman said that was always what impressed him most about me. Happy chance that directs our lives.
Yes.
That was one of them.
Now, you started part-time at MIT in 51 because you were also involved with something with the AEC.
That's correct. I had even before I went to MIT, I was asked by Marion Boyer, who was then the general manager of the Atomic Energy Commission, to start what we decided to call an operations analysis group in his office in Washington in order to determine the potential effectiveness of various new processes for the Atomic Energy Commission and how they might be combined together to produce fissionable material, either by isotope separation or by transmutation, in the most efficient manner. There needed to be a whole series of processes put together, going back all the way to mining, refining of uranium, production of uranium compounds, and then either production of plutonium, of uranium metal for use in reactors, or production of uranium hexafluoride for use in a gaseous diffusion plant, and then the subsequent operation of either the transmutation factories or the isotope separation plants, of which there are still four in competition: electromagnetic process, the gaseous diffusion process, thermal diffusion, and the gas centrifuge. And Marion Boyer, the general manager of the Atomic Energy Commission, wanted somebody to come down and set up a small office reporting directly to him, which would evaluate the potential of these processes, the likely economics, and the most efficient way of combining them all together so that one led to the other and ultimately produced the desired fissionable material at the least overall cost. And Whitman was temporarily assigned to Washington, I forget in what capacity, but he was down there too. And even before I reported to work at MIT, I was asked to come to Washington and set up this operations analysis staff, which would evaluate these processes, become familiar with their prospective economics, and determine the most efficient way to combine them all together so that with the least cost, the least time delay, and the least utilization of scarce uranium resources, the maximum amount of fissionable material, taking into account the relative amount that was needed of uranium-235 and plutonium for a bomb, how these all things might be operating in the most efficient way together. And I was asked to come down and set up that operation in the first place. I was assisted by a very able fellow from Y-12 plant in Oak Ridge named Charlie Thornton, and Paul Fine, who was a theoretical physicist from Los Alamos, brought the precise knowledge of the plutonium processes to our operation, something that I hadn't become familiar with until that time. And there was a fourth person whose name I don't remember, but at any rate, we did represent all of the phases, the most important components of the Manhattan Project. We worked together very harmoniously, and we helped devise a sort of a rule of thumb or a procedure that the Atomic Energy Commission was, yes, that's what it was called then. This was before there was a Department of Energy. Atomic Energy Commission could decide how much to expand the plutonium production reactors, how many new isotope separation plants to build, and whether they should be the electromagnetic type or the gaseous diffusion type or even the thermal diffusion type. So we had sort of a combined operations group, and I was there for only about 8 months getting it started, but we got it off to a very good start. And my deputy, Charles D. Witt Thornton, C.D.W. Thornton, took over after I left and made a very successful
unit of it, which I think doubtless saved the government a lot of money because it allocated its resources in an optimum manner among these different processes. Mm-hmm. We had to estimate how much each one would cost and how much bomb-effective material could produce. Uranium-235 was only about a third as good as plutonium in terms of the mass that was needed for a given bang, so we had to take that into account. And the length of time it would take to start these plants up, we were given different goals as to how much material to have produced at such and such a time. So we developed a combined operations plan, which, so far as I know, the Department of Energy is still using, although its goals are still entirely different now. And all of us, myself and Thornton and Paul Fine, have long since left the scene.
What was MIT looking for initially? Did they just want to have something about nuclear engineering in the curriculum? Had they thought about going beyond that? It was just
Whitman and the president of MIT at that time, who was Carl Compton, were sure that these revolutionary developments of the Manhattan Project, which were largely engineering-based, were bound to introduce a whole new set of concepts and technologies into an engineering education, and they felt that it should have a proper place in the MIT curriculum. It turned out that MIT was the second school to introduce a nuclear engineering curriculum. The first one was North Carolina State University, where another refugee from the Manhattan Project had gone to teach, a fellow named Clifford Beck. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was very able fellow in getting this started too. So they got started about 6 months before we did, and it was quite helpful to me to go down to North Carolina State and see what kind of a curriculum Beck had started himself. But at MIT, I was the first person on the scene, and Whitman assigned to work with me after about a 3 month hiatus Thomas H. Pickford, whom you've doubtless heard about, who was my co-author on... Have you seen the book Nuclear Chemicals?
Yes, they're here. We looked at them earlier.
Yeah. Who had been a director of MIT's practice school at Oak Ridge and was familiar with the process was at Oak Ridge, and was a very valuable colleague of mine because he'd had a lot of first-hand experience with these plants as they were started up, both the X-10 plant for the production of plutonium on a pilot plant scale, and the K-25 and Y-12 plants for production of uranium-235. So it was very well-conceived idea on Whitman's part to bring Pickford and myself together. And we had the enthusiastic support of the two deans of engineering, the one that was there when I first came, whose name I'm ashamed to say I can't remember, and his subsequent successor, Carl Richard Soderberg. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was a very well-known mechanical engineer.
I've heard the name somewhere along the line, but that's all.
A brilliant man. And those deans gave me all the support I needed. The chemical engineering department, under whose benevolent stewardship I first served as a division, under Walter Whitman, were very helpful, and we got off to a very good start.
What, you had to organize courses, something which had never been done before.
Well,
basically,
that's an exaggeration. Cliff Beck at North Carolina State had started some instruction, and I went down there and saw what his courses consisted of and decided what courses we would first offer. And as I remember them, they were an introduction to nuclear engineering, which taught the basic nuclear physics that was needed, and then the engineering aspects, but on a very elementary scale. Nuclear reactor theory, which made use of the then being declassified information on how to calculate critical masses and things of that kind. nuclear reactor engineering, which described the heat transfer and fluid flow and mechanical stress and strain features of nuclear reactors. What was the fourth subject? The nuclear fuel cycle. Processes which were used to convert uranium ore into uranium hexafluoride and uranium metal, and the processes used to refine plutonium after it was produced, after it was removed from reactors, and also how to dispose of radioactive waste, which was an important aspect of the problem even back in those days.
But within a couple of years, I mean, that started in 1951. By 1953, that's only 2 years later, you gave your first MS in nuclear engineering.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, started.
Well, by that time, the curriculum had increased to about perhaps as many as six subjects. And I had, in addition to Pickford, I had a, gosh, I wish my memory was better, and I wish I had those chapters here. I had a very able theoretical chemist here, Mel Clark, that was his name, who was able to teach reactor dynamics and other topics that I just wasn't a master of myself at all. And and we brought aboard, oh dear, very able fellow that didn't stay with us long.
It's not Mason, is it?
Well, Mason was my alter ego in terms of chemical engineering and things of that kind. Hadn't I mentioned Mason already? I should have. When Pickford resigned to start a nuclear engineering curriculum at Cal, University of California, we needed somebody immediately to replace him, and Whitman suggested Mason, who had been director of one of MIT's practice schools and wanted to become familiar with nuclear engineering. So that started a lifelong friendship and a very valuable multi-year collaboration at MIT before Mason left to become vice president for research at the Standard Oil Company of Indiana. And then we needed a theoretical chemist, so we brought Mel Clark aboard, and we needed a reactor engineer and designer. Once Whitman decided it was time that MIT had its own reactor, it wasn't Whitman that decided, it was the dean, Carl Richard Soderberg, that made the decision. It was recommended that I interview somebody who was working at Los Alamos. I did, and he declined the job, but he recommended one of his associates named Theos J. Thompson, known to everybody as Tommy Thompson. And Tommy came to MIT and designed our reactor and got it into operation and taught our experimental courses and really made us a first-rate, well-rounded nuclear engineering department.